party watching this remarkable man who had the double, which is rare in politics, although you find it in a few people, an enormous capacity of expressing himself with clarity and strength, and in an arresting way, both in the written word and in the spoken word. And that's the double. And it was quite outstanding. People get it in different ways. Winston had it. Harold Macmillan had it. And yet they all work differently. I know how Ian MacLeod worked to get his ideas and to get his decisions. He worked very much by discussing them with a group of people of ideas who discussed freely. And then he would gather up the views and kind of draw conclusions from them. Yeah. And I had the impression that he did it far more that way than by sitting down with a damp towel around his head. And I have a good deal of sympathy with that. And maybe I learned a lot of that from him, being one of the younger people with whom as in that group, that I did learn that you frequently get the ideas from the interplay of the idea with the personality, and not just by reading in a personless atmosphere. And that was one of my very, very vivid impressions of Ian. This clarity of expression and being able, therefore, to pick out the wheat from the chaff, as we would say. You've got the basic idea and you eliminated the irrelevant matter. Very, very prominent in Ian's thinking. Now, I remember him as Minister of Health. It was before I was in the House, because I mean he was just a great politician too in those days. And of course it was very, very cruel. It was while he was Minister of Health that Eve, who was such a fantastic partner in the whole relationship and such a perceptive politician, a shrewd politician herself, just happened to get polio during that time. And I think her enormous courage, yes. And as you know, Ian was often in pain. Yes. As well, really were very striking, both of them, this fantastic coach. And if I might say so, the total dedication, it really was. Ian was a born politician. Mm. Mm. And he loved it. Mm. What else can I say? I had great privilege of working with him, especially when we were working on finance bills. And again, his capacity to get a group together and to delegate to them. And it was exciting because this is how I learned to work on a finance bill. We met every morning, we looked at the days following, and we decided who was in charge of the amendments, who was going to move them, what advice we needed. Mm. And it was exciting, and you were happy to be totally dedicated to this immediate task. Mm. Mm. Because in those days, we used to take... There's no such thing as going upstairs into a committee on those. In those days, we used to take most of it on the floor of the House. Yes. And he always knew how to draw in people who had a particular specialty. In those days, finance bills, you had the central group working on them, and you're in opposition. But you could draw on a very wide range of experience in the House. You would have someone who knew shipbuilding, you would have someone who knew industry, you would have someone who knew the financial markets, someone who knew the commodity markets. We could always draw in a group of people who knew it. I sometimes fear that we may not be able to do that, but I learned how to do that with Ian. The third thing I just want to say, you'll have to sort it out, is that he did, his politics did have a great philosophical basis. Mm-hmm. Now, I claim that all great politicians who endure have a philosophical basis. He did have that philosophical basis, and it came out in a considerable number of his speeches. It also might have come out in a different way from perhaps the one I think so many people are saying, oh, he belonged to this post-war consensus. Ian was deeper than that. He really was. if you look at one of the early One Nation documents, and I can't lay my hand on it, you will find something which says, not the deepest philosophy, but a very fundamental appreciation of it. You'll find something, because I've looked it out since I've been here, which says that early 50s, that you really have to have policies which can create wealth before you can do as much as you want to do about helping other people and distributing it to further your objectives. And in that, because it was after the first period of socialism, he said it is quite clear that from socialism, policies have gone much too far towards distribution and ignored the absolute vital necessity of the creation of wealth. And therefore, by implication, that you can never in any of your, and I learned this from you, in any of your policies, ignore the fact that it is human beings who are your instrument. And unless you bring out the very best in them and have policies which keep down the very worst in them, you will not get the best kind of way of life, the best kind of community. Because life is a community. It's not so much a society as a concept, but a community is a real and living thing. And you make your community live by the way in which you react, by the way in which you treat one another, yes, and by the yes. things. The only way in which government can carry out its policy is through the individuals. Now, you will have seen that is the deeper philosophical kind. You'll see that coming out in the One Nation quite early. Now, the other thing that I think people haven't yet, or I didn't see, but you may have got it, is just the way in which I looked at it. But when we were working up to, we'd been in power from until 64, I'll come back to the other thing. When we were coming up to the 1970 election, we did have our study groups. We were all passionately involved in them. I know that I had carried out a number of them. Different portfolios myself, but we did meet. And my goodness me, so did I. I learned to do it later, before the 1979. But it wasn't getting a miscellaneous collection of policies, it was getting a cohesive view. And if you remember, we were called Selsdon Man, because you go back to look at that period, and if you remember, they were... I can only put it this way, they had a passion about them to get Britain right. A real passion. Because we knew that we weren't living up to this enormous potential. And Ian was very much a man of political passion. Although some people said, you know, you have to use all the technology and bring Britain into the technological. Below that, passion to get below that desire to get Britain with the latest technology, getting rid of restrictive practices and so on, and dealing with the unions, was the passion that Britain was not living up to the character which were her people. And that character, as you know, is a character of initiative. The British people didn't have to be told what to do. They had their own self-starters. And that really informed the Selsdon Man and was really why we came in with policies with which we all fundamentally believed. Now, of course, Ian did not, I think, had Ian lived, I think we might never have made the U-turn because it was a passion. And he had much more experience than those of us who came. But it was a tragedy that we made that U-turn. And I think that had Ian lived, we would not. Because of this, the passion which informed the policy and the colossal ability to communicate. Now, you then go back to this period, which was the 1963. It was a double, a triple tragedy. First, in a way that we lost Ian MacLeod, who was undoubtedly a very great politician. Through an illness, I think, you know, that had he ridden the illness out,
yes,
we might, things might have been different. Mm. But equally, I must say that 1963, a year to an election, I think, too, that had we not had the split in the party, I think we would have won in 1964. Mm. Because Alec Douglas Hume is a very great man. Mm. If I might put it this way, one of the most classless men I've ever come across. By the time you're the 14th Earl of Hume, you're not interested in anything except people. You've got all the rest. You know that it's people that make the world go round and you're interested in them. In each of them, my goodness me, he was. When I was passionate about the lot of widowed mothers, Alec was interested. He was interested in each person for what they were, not who their father was, their background, what position they held at all. And he was a marvelous person. Absolutely marvelous, and I felt if we hadn't had that split. And I must say to you that I felt it was, first I felt it was a pity that Harold gave up when had he ridden out the illness, he wouldn't have needed a second day. But having given up, Alec was a marvelous person, and if we had not had the split, we would have got through and never had that period from 64 to 70. And thirdly, I didn't understand, knowing that it's your cause that matters more than anything else, why, if I might put it, our two greatest different exponents of politics in the top rank of politics. One, Ian, with the philosophy and the expression and the shrewdness and the instinct. He partly got his ideas by instinct. And the other, Enoch, this colossal brain, this analytical things, but also certain intellectual beliefs and politics, equally passionately held, but it didn't come out. His passion was a dispassionate passion. Mm. Do you understand?
Absolutely.
Well, as Ian's. Mm. I found I didn't understand why these two, both of whom I greatly admired, withheld their fantastic talents and abilities from a person like Alec Douglas Hume, whom as one human being to another one couldn't help but admire for his depth, for his quality of service. I understood the technicalities. Mm. Because that tell me what worried me about it. What worried me was that in going that way, we had, if there was a constitutional nicety, I thought I'd got the one and not the other one. It was what I thought was a constitutional nicety of assuming the result of a by-election. Mm-hmm. You see, when he was asked to form a government, it was clear that we could not have a prime minister in the Lords. People wouldn't have accepted that. And therefore, it had to assume that he would win that by-election, and I was very worried about whether you really were entitled to make that assumption. But all right, I mean, very shortly afterwards, it ceased to be a question of whether he would win, and he won. Mm. And it seemed from that time we pulled together, because if you believe in a cause, you win it. Now, that, I'm afraid, is a criticism, but I happen to believe it. The other period I remember was, and you would call what was called the left-wing period, was his period as colonial secretary, but I wouldn't call it myself the left-wing period. It was, I think, a very practical realization that there was no way in which Britain could defend, administer, the many different colonial territories that we had. So it wasn't a question of whether they would have done better with a few more years of administration or not. We couldn't do it. And therefore, we had to do the level best we can. We had, mercifully, we had, our great system was that we taught sound administration to the people, unlike some other colonies. We taught the rule of law, which they might never have known. Sound administration, a rule of law, and education are three things upon which we had already embarked. And therefore, we had, in fact, to come to bring them forward as fast as we could to an independence on the very best standards. And that meant, I think, many of the policies, practical policies, which Ian pursued. I didn't see it as much as a practical thing, but also bearing in mind that fundamentally we were the sort of people who taught good administration. We weren't a bureaucratic people. I remember, there were only about 400 people in the Sudan civil service, administering Sudan. We had far fewer in India, although India by that time had come to independence and showed that it could be done. And we had some very, very difficult things in Kenya and the Mau Mau, I remember very, very much. And of course, the history of Uganda has not exactly been one which lends distinction to freedom from colonialism. But it was a practical thing which recognized that we could not, however much we would have wished to have taken it in slower time. That was not the world that we were living in. And indeed, the very, very, we had deprived ourselves of the very resources which enabled us to win the Great War. We had, by winning the Great War, putting everything in the defense of freedom. We had deprived ourselves of those very great resources. And we had to steadily to go on then to go on to accept that, and then to start much later. Didn't come on from that. We went through a period of great pessimism, which again I think would not have happened had Ian been there. And so it took us a very long time. It was left really to my time to have enough, to have just perhaps a little bit of the spark, which could be fanned into a flame, which I learned from Ian, and also from Alec. Alec was a very deep person whose whole viewpoint was informed by his deep Christianity. And so, in a way, we have brought to fruition, I think, so many of the things which we set out and upon which we embarked in 1970, and of which a great goodly measure was due to Ian. Now, that's how I feel. I think I've got most of it in I can help you.
Extremely full first answer, Prime Minister. Extremely helpful. There are naturally a couple of points I'd just like to follow up on, if I might. Just on the 1963 leadership crisis, they, of course, Enoch Powell and Ian MacLeod argued that really the person who should have got
he was a good leader of the House because he could command the House.
Yes. Do you think it was... On that point, I mean, do you think one of his problems at that period, I don't know whether you remember seeing him in the House at that period, was that he was also party chairman, which seems nowadays a curious combination of roles?
No, I don't find it at all difficult. The idea that when you become leader of the House, you drop your beliefs is quite absurd. It is not unusual to be party chairman and leader of the House. It's the idea that some leaders of the House get they kind of forget their party allegiance. You're leader of the House to get the government's business through. It is part of our belief that you honour the traditions of the House. So there's no difficulty.
No.
You get in because you have a passionate belief in your policies. The idea that all of a sudden they don't matter is to me a heresy.
Just returning, if we could, to the 63. Their argument was, of course, that the person...
Incidentally, he could get up and make an impromptu speech. I have seen him do it. He didn't at the party conferences. I remember saying to him sometimes, how in the world do you think of those things? And he said, well, you know, when you get the adrenaline flows at the last moment, they just come. Well, some of us, the adrenaline flows, but we can't get those phrases. Yes, go on, wasn't it?
Sorry, just on 63, I did just want to ask you this, that... they felt so strongly, felt very strongly, that Rab Butler should have been the leader, and that the whole way in which the process had taken place, they
I thought Rab Butler's service to the party was remarkable, his service to the country, absolutely remarkable. Really and truly remarkable. And I agreed. But you see, that isn't the point. The point is what happens when the leader is finally chosen and you pull in behind him because of the cause. Mm. And he really was, Alec was a remarkable person, is a remarkable person, is still a remarkable person.
Yes. I've talked with him about this.
Alec's essence is service before self.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. He's interesting on this. He clearly cannot understand even now why, at the end of the day, they wouldn't serve, given that the others had. It's a fascinating thing. Could I just... Sorry to jump about like this, but could I just move on, move back to the period just before 1970? Am I right in thinking that the various proposals, some of which you implemented at education... and specifically abolishing free school milk. Was that something that had come from Ian McLeod's
That wasn't in policy at all. It was after we got back. We simply had, in fact, to carry out the general policy of cutting public spending. And the question was, where was it least damaging to cut it? So, I mean, the important thing was education and to keep in the milk to the small, to the young people. There's quite a lot of milk wasted, you know. So that wasn't any part
it
of the policy
a,
beforehand, nor was it thought of.
Yeah.
No, nor was it thought of beforehand. It may have been thought of, but in the it came around very quickly. So it may well have been, I suppose, if you look and see when it came round. It was not long after we'd been there that we had to have, when we got in, because of course we had to have a budget fairly quickly.
Yes.
It was no part of the actual policy. It was when you got in, how did you best implement your undertaking to cut public spending? And it came, you know, quite as... it came from with the proposals from the Treasury, and we adapted them, because I said, no, we couldn't... cut it out totally, but no, I remember, don't forget that, I mean, when I was a child, you know, we paid tuppence halfpenny a week for milk, and in a rapidly a society with a much higher standard of living, it didn't seem impossible to ask for some payment, except for the tinies from 5 to 7.
You said also about the period from 1970 after Ian McLeod's death that you thought that if he'd lived, then the U-turn might not have taken place because of his passion and his strong feeling
and
about
his and his powers of persuasion.
Yes. Do you others indeed have argued to me that he had such an abhorrence of unemployment that when he saw unemployment rising, he would have.
Well, the U-turn wasn't why U-turn came. The U-turn was on Upper Clyde shipbuilders, and the U-turn was after the Colt. The coal depot. That was why the U-turn came.
And Ian McLeod would not have done the U-turn on that sort of issue.
I think that he would have. I think the arguments would have been balanced. But I personally think that he would have come out on the side of proceeding with our fundamental objectives. I may be wrong. But to me, he was much stronger on the philosophical side than most people, or many people seem to think.
Yes. Do you remember him expressing any views in Shadow Cabinet before 1970 on Europe, on the European community? And if I could just say why I ask you this, someone who knew him well thought that he'd really cooled on the idea of Europe, or was certainly worried about public opinion on the issue. Indeed, it has been said to me that Ian McLeod was quite in favour of the Conservatives committing themselves to a referendum before the Labour Party did. Has that got any ring to you at all?
No, I can't remember. No. You'd just need to go through, would it? It would be shown in the minutes, wouldn't it? Sure. Perhaps not. It was Reggie Maudling who wasn't keen,
you
know.
That's right.
Who wasn't at all keen.
Could I just check? You said
it would,
that
of course, have been in keeping, because But I can't say that. I don't recall.
No. Mm. Could I just check? You mentioned what you learnt from Ian McLeod, the way he works and so on. When did you first start working with him? Did you know him from when you first came in the house? Or was
I've known him for quite a long time. I can't quite remember, but don't forget. If you lived in London, I remember he used to come sometimes and talk to the Candidates Association. Sure. We used to have it for years. I knew him.
Yes, yes.
For quite a time.
So it's from before
you
entered the
house. Don't forget, I stood in 1951.
Yes, yes. Do you have recollections, say, reminiscences or anecdotes, perhaps, of him when you were a candidate coming to, a constituency dinner or anything of that sort?
No, anecdotes are the most difficult things always to remember. I always think they're highly artificial and I don't have any. He always told us how he was chosen for the Western Isles.
Yes. And do you have recollections, say, of particular speeches or occasions later on after when you were in the house as well?
No, the speech that we all remember most, I think, was the one at the party conference, would let the Liberals dream their dreams, the Socialists scheme their schemes, but we have work to do. Mm. It was, but I can hear his voice. I mean, you've just looked at it. I mean, it just wasn't, now let the Liberals dream their dreams, let the Socialists, we have work. Let the Liberals dream their hopes, the scheme. It's fantastic. It was the intonation that was.
Yes.
And I'm afraid it doesn't do him justice. That was perhaps not, not one of the great political utterances. But now, about 2 more minutes, Rob, because I have
the Nobel Prize winner. You've covered so much ground.
I thought when I looked at your things that I had better say the things which I remember. I do again say Eve. It really was very much. Eve was terrific. She was a magistrate. I remember Eve. Leading a debate, opening a debate on defence at the party conference. Eve was very much, a part of the political drive. She wasn't limited. That is again what she wasn't limited to the health and welfare and the London magistrate. She was in the real big strategic. Decisions.
Yes. There was just one final specific issue, and this was, of course, the issue of immigration, 1968, when Enoch was sacked from the shadow cabinet.
Yes.
Do you remember Ian McLeod's position at that time? I mean, obviously, I've read things and talked with people, and they talk about his very strong views on immigration. How did you see that at that time? Did you share his view on that, or
I think Enoch was fully behind Ted's decision. I think, wasn't he? As far as I know, Ian McLeod was fully behind Ted's decision.
Yes, he was. There was quite a bit of trouble in the constituents. Well, as you know, afterwards, people like Nigel Fisher were having trouble and so on. And he was certainly fully behind Ted's decision. But on the policy of immigration itself, I think he was probably more well on the Liberal.
You go and look at some of Ted's speeches on immigration before the 1970 election. And it wasn't that we were quite for limiting immigration, no doubt about that. But the question, I remember it vividly, those people, once they are here, and Enoch too said this, they must be treated in everywhere as the rest of us, like full British citizens with equal rights and responsibilities, but we simply could not go on taking more and more in. Now you go and look at Ted's, but that was the policy. So the two things which I agreed.
Quite. Could I just ask you very finally? You did say some of this in your opening answer, but how would you assess, do you think he's had a lasting impact on the party? I mean, suppose there hadn't been an Ian McLeod, do you think the Conservative Party would have been very different in the post-war period? Would it be different now? Do you see
I think it's very difficult to answer that, because we who worked with him are very subjective. And he was a powerful personality. And in politics, powerful personalities matter very much indeed. He was a person who would put his... when he spoke, you listened. And I can only think that had he lived, it would have been different. He was a powerful personality. He had strong views. He had this communication. And as I indicated, you've got both the thought and the communication added to that, the communication in the two great media of the time, the spoken and the written word.
Yes, I mean, I can remember now, I can remember seeing his party political broadcasts quite clearly in the 1960s.
Yes.
And they were, I mean, it's hard to think of party political broadcasts being really.
It was a style that we are, it's a different style today, but my goodness me, it was a powerful style. When you have a powerful person, and a person who's was in politics for what, because for what he could do for the country. It was a passion, it was not a living, you know. It. So I think it would have perhaps have been different. Alas, it's so long ago. Just when he came to the zenith, and because he stayed in the house that day, and insisted on staying in the house on just one of the early economic debates. And I remember to this day, I think it was Francis Pym who rang me up. Late at night, rang us all up. We would not like you just to hear from the news, but yeah, shock. Now, I must go and greet the Nobel Prize winners.
Right. I'm very grateful. It was indeed.